Chapter 4. Working with the dead was thirsty work, and Paladis Novandio took a sip of brackish water from the wooden barrel set up at the door of the crematorium. The men who worked to load the bodies into the incinerator were hard men, inured to the cold, stiff reminders of their own mortality. They worked without words, hauling the pallets of the dead towards the giant furnace built into the rock, stripping them of their clothes and dignity before taking them by ankles and wrists and swinging them into the fire. The petitioner's city had no shortage of dead, one of the few commodities it had in abundance. The piles of clothes were sorted and cleaned by the women of the temple before being distributed to those in need. On some days it seemed as though the population of the city never changed, and you might stop someone thinking they were miraculously returned to life, but who was simply wearing the coat of a dead man. Paladis took a measure of comfort in knowing the dead could yet give something to those they left behind. Most of them, anyway. He wiped the ashen residue of the incinerator from his face with a mixture of the water and his own sweat. The taste of cinders and fat was always at the back of his throat, but it never occurred to him to do anything else. Without any meaningful civic authority, bodies were a common sight on the streets of the petitioner's city. Those who had given up, or simply been in the wrong place at the wrong time. Death could take you in any number of ways, too many to count. The millions of people coming to Terra filtered through the mountains en route to the palace, but only a fraction of those numbers made it this far. That still left thousands who clamoured at the gates, beseeching the faceless warriors who marched along the battlements to grant them passage. The streets of the petitioner's city were filled with those who sought meaning in their life, answers to their questions, or those who simply came to view the magnificence of the Emperor's domain. Paladis remembered a time when the petitioner's city had retained a semblance of an ordered community, when it had been small enough to maintain a form of order and stability. But as more and more people found their way to the walls of the palace, its ordered structure had begun to break down. The buildings that appeared overnight and pushed the city limits further down the mountains became steadily more temporary, more numerous, and altogether more squalid. Then the gangs had moved in, sensing opportunity amongst the desperate petitioners like vultures circling a wounded man in the desert. Gangs from the mountains, gangs from the plains, and gangs from the battlefields of Unity were drawn to the ever-expanding city, sensing vulnerable people ready to be exploited. The killings had begun, bloody and designed to spread fear like a contagion. Babu Dakal's gang had been the worst. His men were stronger, faster, and more ruthless than any others, and there was no level of mutilation and degradation to which they would not stoop. Paladis had seen one of his men stabbed through his eyes and left to bleed to death on the steps of a Medicaid facility. That man's killers had their limbs hacked off and their broken bodies left impaled on tall spears for the carrion birds to devour. Revenge killings, honour killings, random killings. None of it made any sense, and by the time the worst of it was over, only Babu Dakal was left standing. No one knew where the feared gang warlord had come from, but there were many rumours. Some claimed he was a member of the Legio Custodes who had never come back from a blood game. Others said he was one of the Emperor's Thunder Warriors who had somehow survived the end of the Wars of Unity. Yet more claimed he was a space marine whose body had rejected the last stage of his elevation to post-human and had fled before he could be put down. Most likely he was simply a ruthless bastard who had proved to be more of a ruthless bastard than anyone else. But his evil reputation didn't put off those who desperately sought entry to the palace, and day by day, year by year, the petitioner's city grew ever larger. Armed forces from the palace periodically swept the streets of the city, gathering up the dregs and lowlifes too slow or too stupid to hide. but it achieved little more than salving the consciences of the noble-born lords of Terra. For all intents and purposes, the petitioner's city was a law unto itself. Imperial heralds, escorted by hundreds of armed men, occasionally ventured as far as the proclamation arch to read the names of those whose luck had finally turned and would be allowed to enter the palace. Few of those called ever made their way through the archway to the petitioner's gate. Most were either lying dead in a nameless alley, or, having given up all hope of ever attaining entry, had simply returned to whatever corner of the globe they had once called home. Paladis had been one of the lucky ones, called to the palace with his family while the petitioner's city was still a place of quiet order. He had come from the southern lands of the Romani, where he had plied his trade as a crafter of stone and worker of marble in the palaces of the burgeoning technocratic cartel houses that rose from the drift sand at the edge of the Dust Bowl. But as the megastructures rose higher and higher and steel and glass replaced the ancient weight of stone, Paladis found himself forced to seek work elsewhere. With his wife and newborn sons, Paladis had crossed a landscape still bearing the scars of global war that had raged for as long as anyone could remember. Only now was it beginning to reveal the potential glory spoken of by the Emperor's heralds. In search of that glory, he had crossed the peaks of Cerberus and followed the Carpathian Arch before entering the homeland of the Rus, and following the trade caravans along the ancient Silk Road across the plains of Nakhchivan. There they turned east, through Aryana and the newly fertile lands of the Indoi, before the ground began to rise and the mountains that marked the edge of the world came into view. It had been an awe-inspiring sight, one that would be forever etched on his memory, but one that had become bittersweet in the years that followed. Paladis turned from the memories of murder and pushed through the plastic slats that kept the worst of the ash from leaving the crematorium. The air was thick with it. The incinerator would need to be emptied soon, as the remains of the dead were backing up in the firebox. He hung up his rubberized apron and removed his heavy canvas gauntlets. The wetted cloth around his mouth and nose came off next, followed by his ash-smeared goggles. Taking a moment to run his hands through his unkempt hair, Paladis stepped through the doorway into the main area of the temple. As always, it was crowded with mourners, and the soft sound of weeping women and men drifted to the stoic angels worked into the eaves. Paladis felt his eyes drawn to the smooth curves of the vacant angel, and placed his hand on its cool marble surface. The dark nephrite was from Syria, hand-finished and polished to a degree of smoothness that only an artisan's love could fashion. And yet Vadok Singh had rejected it and cast it aside. He felt his hands bunch into fists at the thought of the Emperor's war mason. So obsessed with his art was Singh that he cast aside anything that did not match his exacting demands. Materials, tools, plans, or people. Especially people. His gaze was drawn to the featureless face, again wondering whose likeness had been planned for its unfinished surface. It didn't matter now. It would never be completed, so the question was immaterial. He dragged his eyes from its blank countenance as he heard someone call his name and looked across the chamber. Roxanne sat with Maya and her two surviving children, both of whom had responded well to the counterseptics she had obtained from Antioch. The woman's husband, Esteban, sat to one side, and Paladis felt a stab of annoyance. He had forbidden the man to distribute more of his Lectitio Divinitatis leaflets, knowing it was unwise to attract additional attention to a place people insisted on calling a temple. Roxanne raised her hand, and he returned the gesture, knowing it was only a matter of time until she brought trouble down upon them. Someone like her could not remain hidden forever, even in a place like the petitioner's city. No one here knew it, but she was an exceptionally rare woman, and her family would eventually demand that she return to them, by force if need be. He walked over to her, giving smiles of sympathy to those who mourned and nods of understanding to those who stood with them. Roxanne looked up as he approached and put her hand on the head of the child nestled in Maya's arms.
"Looks like the medicine's working," she said. "I think they'll both be fine."
"Well, I'm glad to hear it," said Paladis, tousling the hair of the boy beside Maya.
"His name's Arik," said Maya,
reaching out to stroke the child's cheek. "A good, strong name," said Paladis, addressing the boy. "Do you know what it means?" The boy shook his head, and Paladis made a fist. "Arik was one of the Emperor's lightning bearers in the first epoch of Unity," he said. "They say he was taller than the Hollow Mountain, and that he carved the pass at Mohan with his fists. Give it time, and I think you might grow as big." The boy smiled and made a fist too. Maya reached out and placed a palm on her son's shoulder.
"Emperor love you," she said. "Are you blessed with children?"
Paladis sighed wearily but nodded.
"Two boys."
"Are they here?"
asked Maya.
"I would love to meet them and tell them what a kind father they have."
"They were here," said Paladis. "They died."
"Oh, I'm so sorry," said Maya. "I didn't know."
"What happened to them?"
asked Arik.
"Hush now, Arik," cried Maya.
"No, it's all right," said Paladis. "He should know and understand such things."
Paladis took the boy by the shoulders and looked him straight in the eye, wanting him to understand the gravity of what he was about to hear.
"I once worked for a powerful man who desired I work for no other," said Paladis. "I did not like such restrictions and secretly accepted a commission from another, though I knew the price of discovery would be high. The powerful man learned of my other work and sent men to my house to express his displeasure. I was working in a limestone quarry west of the palace, but my wife and two boys were home. The men cut my wife's throat and shot my boys in the heart. I returned from the quarries to find all three lying where they had fallen."
The boy's eyes widened, and Paladis knew he had frightened him. That was good. Fear would keep him alive to the many ways in which death was stalking him.
"You poor man,"
said Maya, while pulling her son away from Paladis. He deflected her fearful sympathy and his own rising grief by looking over at her husband, who sat to one side. His face was expressionless, crushed and empty, as though all the life had been drained from him. Paladis knew that expression well. Sometimes he felt it was the only one he wore.
"Esteban,"
said Paladis, but the man didn't look up. He repeated the man's name, and at last his head came up.
"What?"
"Your sons are recovering, Esteban," he said. "You must be relieved."
"Relieved?"
said Esteban with a shrug.
"Vali and Chio are with the Emperor now. If anything, they're the lucky ones. The rest of us have to live in this world with its suffering and pain. Tell me, priest, why should I be relieved?"
Anger touched Paladis.
"I'm sorry for your loss, but you have two sons who need you, and I am not a priest."
"You are,"
said Esteban.
"You don't see it, but you are a priest. This is a temple, and you are its priest."
Paladis shook his head, but before he could rebut Esteban's words, the crack of splintering timber filled the building, followed by the heavy thud of a door falling from its frame. Cries of alarm sounded, and people began moving from the entrance. Seven men stepped over the ruin of the door. Big men, hard men, dangerous men. They were swathed in furs, leather straps, and plates of steel beaten into the semblance of armour. Two wore spiked helmets, one carried a vicious, flanged mace of pig iron, while another carried a bulky gun with a flared barrel and lengths of copper piping running along the barrel to a sparking cylinder filled with tiny arcs of lightning. Swirling tattoos writhed on the muscles of their beefy arms, and each man bore a jagged brand of a lightning bolt above his right eye.
"Babu Dakhal's men," hissed Roxanne,
but Paladis waved her to silence. He stepped into the central aisle, his hands held up before him.
"Please,"
he began,
"this is a place of peace and solemnity."
"Not anymore,"
said a broad-shouldered figure, entering the building behind his vanguard. He towered over the seven dangerous men, making them look small in comparison. Crossed bandoliers of knives made an X on his chest, and a trio of jangling meat hooks hung from his belt next to a holster containing a wide pistol that was surely too heavy for any normal man to fire, without losing his arm to recoil. Barbed iron torques encircled his biceps, making the pulsing veins throb like writhing snakes beneath the skin. The man's flesh was emblazoned with the tattooist's art, myriad representations of lightning bolts, hammers, and winged raptors. What little of his natural skin tone remained was the unhealthy pallor of a corpse, and a thin line of blood oozed from the corner of his mouth. But it was the man's eyes that told Paladis who had come for retribution. Pupils so fine they were little more than black dots in a sea of petechial hemorrhages. The man's eyes were literally red with blood.
"Gota,"
said Paladis. Athena rose through the central spine of the Whispering Tower, carried aloft on the double helix of gravity-defiant particles. It made her skin itch abominably, and the scar tissue that capped her amputated thighs throbbed painfully in the flux. Why the Whispering Tower's builders had thought a pneumatic lift was unnecessary was a constant mystery, and she never failed to curse them whenever she was forced to move vertically through its structure. She badly needed to see Mistress Sarashina, and rose through the levels of the tower towards the upper wing of the Honora Critica Alcheramundi, the great dream library of the City of Sight. A stack of papers and dream logs rested in her lap, a volatile record of her latest flight into the immaterium that required a second interpretation. No one had a better understanding of Vatic prognostication than Anik Sarashina, and if anyone could provide clarification of her latest vision, it would be her. At last, the stream of particles came to a diffuse end, and she used her manipulator arm to work the controls of her chair. It lurched as one repulsor field was exchanged for another, and Athena winced as the drum-taut tissue of her ravaged limbs pulled tight. Passing through the arched entrance of the library, Athena nodded to the detachment of black sentinels stationed by the heavily armoured doors. She felt the humming machine spirits set into the arch cast their unfeeling eyes over her, ensuring she brought nothing forbidden into the library. Towering shelves, rearing hundreds of metres into the air, filled this section of the Honora Critica Alcheramundi. Groaning stacks radiating from the central hub, filled with interpretive texts, dream diaries, vision logs, and the many books of common astropathic imagery. Every vision received and sent from the City of Sight was here, a complete record of communication that passed between Terra and the wider galaxy. Scores of hunched astropaths drifted through the stacks like green ghosts, seeking clarification of a vision, while elder telepaths added freshly approved symbols to the ever-growing library. Every addition to the library was ratified by Artemidon Zyun, the custodian of this invaluable repository, and Athena saw the corpulent old telepath shuffling through the stacks with a gaggle of bobbing lumen globes, and harried aides following in his wake. Athena circled the hub until she sensed Sarashina's presence in the section devoted to elemental symbolism in visions. She floated toward Sarashina, and her former tutor looked up as Athena approached. Though astropaths lacked traditional visual acuity, their blind sight allowed them to perceive the world around them just as well as sighted individuals.
"Athena,"
said Sarashina with a smile of genuine warmth.
How are you?
Pained and tired, said Athena. Is there any other way for an astropath to feel?
Sarashina nodded in understanding. Athena caught the brief flare of sympathetic regret and swallowed her anger at Sarashina's pity.
Have you come to talk to me about Kai Zulane?
Asked Sarashina, ignoring Athena's brusque tone.
No, the throne knows he is damaged.
Beyond repair?
Hard to say for sure, said Athena. There's a lot of aversion in him, and he's psi-sick because of it. But I think I can bring him back.
So, if you are not here to talk about Kai, what else is troubling you?
I had a precept concerning the 10th Legion,
said Athena,
right after I saw Zulane.
Sarashina gestured to the end of the stack furthest away from the hub, where numerous reading tables and data engines were spread along the curved inner face of the tower. Sensing Athena's unease, Sarashina picked an empty table far from astropaths studying the touchscript books and manuscripts. Athena floated behind Sarashina and deposited her dream logs on the table.
This precept, asked Sarashina, have you logged it with the conduit?
Not yet. I wanted to speak to you first.
Very well, but log it immediately after we speak. You know the purpose of the 10th Legion's expedition?
Of course, said Athena. And that's what scares the crap out of me, because I don't think it's a true precept.
What do you mean?
I mean, I don't think it's a vision of the future. I think it's happening right now.
Tell me what you saw, said Sarashina. Leave nothing out.
I was on a sun-parched desert when I saw an obsidian statue rise from the sands. A muscular figure clad in a breastplate of burnished iron and chained to a rock. The statue's fists were encased in silver, and sitting on one of them was an amber-eyed falcon with ocean-green plumage and a hooked beak.
The statue is obvious enough, said Sarashina. Prometheus.
Athena nodded. A vision of the titan of ancient myth, who signified belief in humanity even over divine decree, was a common visual metaphor used by astropaths to represent the Primarchs. The silver of the statue's gauntlets was the final confirmation of this one's identity.
Yes, Ferus Manus, said Athena, Primarch of the Iron Hands.
So what happened in this vision?
A shadow fell across the sun, and I looked up to see darkness eclipsing the face of its brightness until it resembled a world of black, granular sand. It's a new symbol, but it's one I've seen a lot of recently.
Istvan V, said Sarashina.
Athena nodded.
No sooner had the sun gone black than the statue of Prometheus pulled against the chains holding it fast to the rock. The falcon took to the air as the metal link shattered, and a spear of fire appeared in the giant's fist. The statue surged forward and cast the spear into the heart of the black sun, and the tip punched into its heart in a shower of blazing sparks.
That bodes well for Lord Dawn's fleet, noted Sarashina.
I'm not finished yet, said Athena.
She took a deep breath before continuing.
Even as the statue slew the sun with its spear cast, I saw it had left much of its inner substance behind. Chunks of obsidian remained stuck to the rock, and I knew the giant had struck prematurely, without his full weight behind the blow. Then the statue sank beneath the sand, and the falcon flew back to the rock. It swallowed the chunks of obsidian, and then took to the air with a caw of triumph.
That is everything? Asked Sarashina.
That's everything,
agreed Athena, tapping her dream records.
I checked my Honora Critica, and it makes for uncomfortable reading.
Sarashina extended her hands, nodding in agreement as her fingers danced over the raised words and letters.
Ferus Manus always was impetuous, she said.
He races ahead of his brothers to Istvan V to deliver the death blow to the rebels, while leaving much of his force behind.
Yes, but it's the hawk with the amber eyes that concerns me,
said Athena. The importance of the falcon is paramount, agreed Sarashina. Its obvious implication is troubling. What elements Ferus Manus leaves behind will be devoured. What other interpretation do you give the falcon?
It's a symbol of war and victory in most cultures.
Which in itself is not troublesome, so what gives you cause for concern?
This,
said Athena, opening her oldest honora critica with her manipulator arm and turning it around. As Sarashina's fingers slipped easily over the pages, her serene expression turned to a frown as the words imprinted on the pages went on. This is ancient belief, said Sarashina.
I know. Many of the gods worshipped by these extinct cultures displayed hawks as symbols of their battle prowess, which just confirms the more obvious symbolism. But I remembered the text of a rubbing taken from a marble sculpture uncovered by the conservatory only a year ago, in the rubble of that hive that collapsed in Nordafrik.
Kairos, said Sarashina with a shudder. I felt its fall. 6 million souls buried under the sands. Terrible. Athena had been aboard Lemuria, one of the great orbital plates circling Terra when Kairos' hive sank into the desert. But she had felt the etheric aftershock of its doom like a tidal wave of fear and pain. An empathic shudder of grief pulsed from Sarashina's aura.
The hive's fall exposed a series of tomb complexes further west, and among the mortuary carvings were hawks. It said that the Egyptians considered the hawk to be a perfect symbol of victory, though they viewed it as a struggle between opposing elemental forces, especially the spiritual over the corrupt, as opposed to physical victory.
And how does that fit within your precept? Asked Sarashina.
I'm getting to that,
said Athena, pushing a sheet of paper towards her.
This is the text of a scroll I copied a few years ago from a deteriorating data coil recovered from the ruins of Neo-Alexandria. It's just a list, a pantheon of old gods, but one name in particular stuck out. Taken together with the amber eyes and the colouring of the hawk's plumage...
Horus, said Sarashina as her finger stopped halfway down the list.
Could the hawk with the amber eyes represent the War Master and his rebels?
Pass this to the conduit, said Sarashina. Now!
Please, said Paladis, don't hurt these people. They have already been through enough.
Gota took a step into the temple, his heavy hobnailed boots sounding like gunshots as he crushed glass and rock beneath them. He swept his gaze around the terrified throng, finally settling on Roxanne. He smiled, and Paladis saw his teeth were steel fangs, triangular like a shark's. Gota pointed at Roxanne.
Don't care about others, he said. Just want her.
The man's voice was impossibly deep, as though dragged unwillingly from some gravelled canyon in his gut. It sounded like grinding rocks, flat and curiously not echoing from the stone walls of the temple.
Look, I know there was some blood spilled, but your men attacked Roxanne, said Paladis. She had every right to defend herself.
Gota's head cocked to one side, as though this argument had never been put to him before. It amused him, and he laughed. Or at least Paladis guessed that the sound of a mountain avalanche coming from his mouth was laughter.
She was trespassing, growled Gota. She needed to pay a toll, but she decided it didn't apply to her. My men were enforcing the Babu's law. She broke the law. Now she has to pay. It's simple. Either she comes with me, or I kill everyone in here.
Paladis fought down his rising tension. All it would take would be one person to panic, and this temple would become a charnel house. Maya sheltered her two boys, while Esteban had his eyes closed and muttered something inaudible with his hands clasped before him. Roxanne sat with her head bowed, and Paladis felt her fear hit him like a blow. So easy to forget how different she is. He took a step towards Gota, but the man raised his hand and shook his head.
"You're fine where you are," said Gota. "But I can see you're hesitating, trying to think if there's some way you can talk your way out of this. You can't. You're also thinking if there's any way the boxy girl can do what she did to the men she killed. She might be able to kill a couple of them, but it won't work on me. And if she tries it, I'll make sure she doesn't die for weeks. I know exactly how fragile the human body is, and I promise you that she'll suffer agonizingly. You know me, and you know I mean what I say."
"Yes, Gota," said Paladis. "I know you, and trust me, I believe every word you say."
"Then hand her over and we'll be gone."
Paladis sighed. "I can't do that."
"You know what she is."
"I do."
"Stupid," said Gota,
drawing his heavy pistol with such swiftness that Paladis wasn't sure what he'd seen until the deafening bang filled the chamber with noise. Everyone screamed and went on screaming as they saw what the gunshot had done to Esteban. It had destroyed him. Literally destroyed him. The impact pulped his upper body, hurling it across the chamber and breaking it apart over the chest of the vacant angel. Ribbons of shredded meat drooled from the statue's praying hands, and sticky brain matter and fragments of skull decorated its featureless face. Maya screamed, and Roxanne threw herself to the floor. Weeping mourners huddled together in the pews, convinced they were soon to join their loved ones. Children screamed in fear, and mothers let them cry. Roxanne looked up at Paladis and reached for the hem of her hood, but he shook his head. Gota flexed his wrist, and Paladis found himself looking down the enormous barrel of a weapon that could obliterate him. Coils of muzzle smoke drifted from the gun, and Paladis could smell the chemical reek of high-grade propellant. The dim light of the temple reflected from an eagle stamped on the pistol's barrel.
"You are next," said Gota. "You'll die, and we'll take the girl anyway."
Paladis felt his body temperature drop suddenly, as though a nearby meat locker had just opened and gusted a breath of Arctic air into the chamber. The hairs on his arms stood erect, and he shivered as though someone had just walked over his grave. Sweat beaded on his brow, and though every one of his senses was telling him the chamber was warm, his body was shivering, like it had on the nights he'd spent on the open plains of Nakhchivan. The sounds of frightened people faded into the background, and Paladis heard the snorting, wheezing, emphysemic breath of something wet and rotten. Colour drained from the world, and even Gota's colourful tattoos seemed dull and prosaic. The cold air bloated the chamber, a sudden swelling of icy breath that seemed to swirl around every living thing and caress it with a repulsively paternal touch. Paladis watched as one of Gota's thugs stiffened, clutching his chest as though a giant fist had reached inside his ribcage and squeezed his heart. The man turned the colour of week-old snow, and he collapsed into a pew, gasping for breath as his face twisted in a rictus mask of pain and terror. Another man fell, as though poleaxed and without the drama of his comrade. His face was pulled tight in a grimace of horror, but his body remained unmarked. Gota snarled and aimed his pistol at Roxanne, but before he could pull the trigger, another of his men shrieked in abject terror. So stark and primal was his scream that even an inhuman monster like Gota was caught unawares. Colour flooded back into the world, and Paladis threw himself to the side as Gota's pistol boomed with deafening thunder. Paladis didn't see what he'd shot at, but heard a buzzing crackle as it hit something. More screaming sounded from the far end of the chamber, frantic, urgent, and terrified. Paladis squirmed along the floor between the pews, knowing something terrible was happening, but with no idea what it was. His breath misted before him, and he saw webs of frost forming on the back of the timber bench at his side. He flinched as Gota fired again, roaring with an anger that was terrifying in its power. The sound of his rage went right through Paladis, penetrating to the marrow and leaving him sick and paralysed with terror. No mortal warrior could vent such battle rage. Pinned to the floor with terror, Paladis wrapped his hands over his head and tried to shut out the sounds of terrified screams. He kept his face pressed to the cold flagstones of the temple floor, taking icy air into his lungs with every terrified breath. The screaming seemed to go on without pause, shrieks of terror and pain overlaid with angry roars of thunderous defiance in a strange battle cant that sounded like the fury of an ancient war god. Paladis remained motionless until he felt a drop of cold water on the back of his neck. He looked up to see the frost on the back of the bench was melting. The freezing temperature had vanished as swiftly as it had arrived. He felt a hand touch his shoulder and cried out, flailing his arms at his attacker.
"Paladis! It's me," said Roxanne. "It's over. He's gone."
Paladis struggled to assimilate that information, but found it too unbelievable to process.
"Gone," he said at last. "How? I mean, why?"
"I don't know," said Roxanne, peeking over the top of the bench.
"Did you do it?"
asked Paladis, as a measure of his composure began to return. He pulled himself upright and risked a quick look over the top of the bench.
"No," said Roxanne. "I swear I didn't. Take a look. This isn't anything I could have done."
Roxanne wasn't lying. Gota was gone, leaving a greasy, fear stink in the air and a fug of acrid gun smoke. Seven bodies lay sprawled by the entrance to the temple. Seven hard, dangerous men. Each one lay unmoving with their limbs twisted at unnatural angles, as though they had been picked up by a simple-minded giant and bent out of shape until they broke. Paladis had seen his share of abused corpses and knew that every bone in their bodies was crushed.
"What in terror's name just happened?"
said Paladis, moving to stand in the centre of the temple.
"What killed these men?"
"Damned if I know," said Roxanne.
"But I'm not going to say I'm not grateful for whatever did it."
"I suppose,"
agreed Paladis, as heads began appearing over the tops of benches. Their fear turned to amazement as they saw Paladis standing amid the ruin of seven men. Paladis saw the awe in their faces and shook his head, holding his hands up to deny any part in their deaths.
"This wasn't me," he said. "I don't know what happened."
The words died in his throat as he looked back down the central passageway of the temple towards the vacant angel. The viscera that had been blown out of Esteban's guts hung from the statue like grotesque festival decorations, and Maya wailed like a banshee at this latest agonizing loss. For a fleeting second, it was as though a pale nimbus of light played around the outline of the statue. Paladis felt the lingering presence of death and was not surprised to see a leering, crimson-eyed skull swimming in the dark-veined marble of the statue's face. It vanished so suddenly that Paladis couldn't be sure he'd seen anything at all.
"So, you have come for me at last?"
he whispered under his breath. Roxanne was at his side a moment later.
"What did you say?"
"Nothing,"
said Paladis, turning away from the statue.
"I wanted to thank you," said Roxanne.
"For what?"
"For not letting them take me."
"You're one of us," he said. "I'd no more let them take you than anyone else."
He saw the disappointment in her eyes and immediately regretted his thoughtless words. But it was too late to take them back now.
"So what happened here?" asked Roxanne.
"Death happened here," said Paladis,
fighting the urge to look over his shoulder at the vacant angel. He lifted his voice so that the rest of his congregation could hear him.
"Evil men came to us and paid the price for their wickedness. Death looks for any chance to take you into his dark embrace, and to walk the path of evil is to bring you to his notice. Look now, and see the price of that path."
The people of the temple cheered, holding one another tight as his words reached them. They had stepped from the shadow of death, and the light beyond had never seemed brighter. The colours of the world were unbearably vivid, and the comfort of the loved one nearby had never been more achingly desirable. They looked at him as the source of their newfound joy, and he wanted to tell them that he had not caused these men to die, that he was as shocked as they were to still be alive. But one look at their enraptured faces told him that no words he could summon would change their unshakable belief in him. Roxanne gestured to the dead bodies.
"So what do we do with them?"
"Same as all the rest," he said. "We burn them."
"Goto won't take this lightly," said Roxanne. "We should get out of here. He'll raise this place to the ground."
"No,"
said Paladis, picking up the strange rifle one of Gota's men had carried.
"This is a temple of death, and when that bastard comes back, he's going to find out exactly what that means."